Continuing, both kinds of movement, after considerable internal debate, created formal organizations. As such, these organizations had to evolve a basic strategy to transform their immediate world in the direction in which they wished it to go. In both cases, the analysis was identical. The key political structure of the modern world they saw to be the state. If these movements were to change anything, they had to control a state apparatus, which pragmatically meant their state apparatus. Consequently, the primary objective had to be obtaining state power. In my interjection, you could see how that immediately served to divide us globally. Continuing, for the social movement, this meant that despite the internationalism of their ideology, workers of the world unite. The organizations they created had to be national in structure, and the objective of these organizations had to be the coming to power of the movement in that state. Similarly, for the national movement, the objective came to be state power in a particular state. To be sure, the jurisdiction of this state was by definition what the national movement was about. Sometimes such a movement sought the creation of an entirely new state, either by succession or by merger. But in other cases, this new state might have already existed in the form of a colonial or a regional administrative entity. The fact that the two varieties of movement define the same strategic objective accounts for their sense of rivalry with each other, particularly when a workers' movement sought to obtain power in an entity out of which a given national movement was seeking to detach a zone in order to create a new state. The parallel objectives, obtaining state power, led to a parallel internal debate on the mode of obtaining state power, which might be defined in polar terms as the legal path of political persuasion versus the illegal path of insurrectionary force. This has often been called reform versus revolution, but these two terms have become so overlaid with polemic and confusion that today they obscure more than they aid analysis. It should be noted that in the case of the social movement, this internal debate culminated during the period between the First and Second World Wars in the existence of two rival and fiercely competitive internationals, the Second and the Third, also known as the conflict between social democrats and communists. My interjection, and what stands behind both, as well as behind the right's philosophic line, is Hegel. Continuing, it should be noted that in the case of the social movement, this internal debate culminated during the period between the First and Second World Wars. Though both the Second and Third Internationals asserted that they had the same objective of socialism, that they were movements based in the working class and on the left, and even, at least for a while, that they assumed the same Marxist heritage, they rapidly became vehemently opposed one to the other, to the extent that their subsequent occasional political convergences, the quote-unquote popular fronts, have seemed at best tactical and momentary. In some sense, this has remained true right up to the present. If one looks at the geography of the movements, one quickly notices a historical correlation. Social democratic movements have become politically strong and have, quote unquote, come to power by electoral means, to be sure, and then in alteration with more conservative parties, almost only in the core states in the world economy, but in virtually all of them. And my interjection, what this is describing is a coming to an understanding between the global state statesmen about the goal of world order. and agreement specifically that it be expressed in a hierarchical arrangement, in theory, open-ended. This is the background context never acknowledged that makes professional left trumpeting of the European social democracies as evidence of the success, quote unquote, or viability of democracy as a political strategy for incrementally improving the quality of society. This is what makes it so dishonest. Continuing. If one looks at the geography of the movements, one quickly notices a historical correlation. Social democratic movements have become politically strong and have come to power by electoral means, to be sure, and then in alteration with more conservative parties, almost only in the core states of the world economy, but in virtually all of them. Communist parties, by contrast, have become politically strong primarily in a certain range of semi-peripheral and peripheral zones, and have come to power sometimes by insurrection, but sometimes as a result of military occupation by the USSR, only in these zones. The only Western countries to which communist parties have been relatively strong for a long period of time are France, Italy, and Spain. And it should be noted that Italy and Spain might well be considered semi-peripheral. In any case, the parties in these three states have long since shed any insurrectionary inclinations. We are therefore, in the 1980s, faced with the following political history of the modern world. Social democratic parties have in fact achieved their primary political objective, coming to power in a relatively large number of core states. Communist parties have in fact come to power in a significant number of semi-peripheral and peripheral countries, concentrated geographically in a band that runs from Eastern Europe to East and Southeast Asia. And in the rest of the world, in many of the countries, nationalist, sometimes even radical nationalist or national liberation movements have come to power. In short, seen from the vantage point of 1848, the success of the anti-systemic movements has been very impressive indeed.